over whom an ancient Athenian of the circle of Aeschylus would have half killed himself with laughter or irritation. But we accept precisely this wild motliness, this medley of the most delicate, the most coarse, and the most artificial, with a secret confidence and cordiality. We enjoy it as a refinement of art reserved expressly for us, and allow ourselves to be as little disturbed by the repulsive fumes and the proximity of the English populace in which Shakespeare's art and taste lives, as perhaps on the Chiaja of Naples, where, with all our senses awake, we go our way, enchanted and voluntarily, in spite of the drain odor of the lower quarters of the town. That as men of the historical sense we have our virtues is not to be disputed. We are unpretentious, unselfish, modest, brave, habituated to self-control and self-renunciation, very grateful, very patient, very complacent, but with all this, we are perhaps not very tasteful. Let us finally confess it, that what is most difficult for us men of the historical sense to grasp, feel, taste, and love, what finds us fundamentally prejudiced and almost hostile, is precisely the perfection and ultimate maturity in every culture and art, the essentially noble in works and men, their moment of smooth sea and halcyon self-sufficiency, the goldenness and coldness which all things show that have perfected themselves. Perhaps our great virtue of the historical sense is in necessary contrast to good taste, at least to the very bad taste, and we can only invoke in ourselves, imperfectly, hesitatingly, and with compulsion, the small, short, and happy godsends and glorifications of human life as they shine here and there. Those moments and marvelous experiences when a great power has voluntarily come to a halt before the boundless and infinite, when a superabundance of refined delight has been enjoyed by a sudden checking and petrifying, by standing firmly and planting oneself fixedly on the still trembling ground. Proportionateness is strange to us. Let us confess it to ourselves. Our itching is really the itching for the infinite, the immeasurable. Like the rider on his forward panting horse, we let the reins fall before the infinite, we modern men, we semi-barbarians, and only in our highest bliss, when we are in most danger. Whether it be hedonism, pessimism, utilitarianism, or eudaimonism, all those modes of thinking which measure the worth of things according to pleasure and pain, that is, according to accompanying circumstances and secondary considerations, are plausible modes of thought and naivetés, which everyone conscious of creative powers and an artist's conscience will look down upon with scorn, though not without sympathy. Sympathy for you? To be sure. That is not sympathy as you understand it. It is not sympathy for social distress, for society with its sick and misfortuned, for the hereditarily vicious and defective who lie on the ground around us. Still less is it sympathy for the grumbling, vexed, revolutionary slave classes who strive after power, they call it freedom. Our sympathy is a loftier and further-sighted sympathy. We see how man dwarfs himself, how you dwarf him. And there are moments when we view your sympathy with an indescribable anguish, when we resist it, when we regard your seriousness as more dangerous than any kind of levity. You want, if possible, and there is not a more foolish, if possible, to do away with suffering. And we? It really seems that we would rather have it increased and made worse than it has ever been. Well-being, as you understand it, is certainly not a goal. It seems to us an end, a condition which at once renders man ludicrous and contemptible and makes his destruction desirable. The disciple of suffering, of great suffering, know ye not that it is only this discipline that has produced all the elevations of humanity hitherto? The tension of soul in misfortune, which communicates to it its energy, its shuddering in view of rack and ruin, its inventiveness and bravery, in undergoing, enduring, interpreting, and exploiting misfortune and whatever depth, mystery, disguise, spirit, artifice, or greatness has been bestowed upon the soul, has it not been bestowed through suffering, through the discipline of great suffering? In man, creature and creator are united. In man, there is not only matter, shred, excess, clay, mire, folly, chaos, but there is also the creator, the sculptor, the hardness of the hammer, the divinity of the spectator, and the seventh day. Do ye understand this contrast? And that your sympathy for the creature in man applies to that which has to be fashioned, bruised, forged, stretched, roasted, annealed, refined, to that which must necessarily suffer and is meant to suffer. And our sympathy, do ye not understand what our reverse sympathy applies to when it resists your sympathy as the worst of all pampering and enervation? So it is sympathy against sympathy. But, to repeat it once more, there are higher problems than the problems of pleasure and pain and sympathy, and all systems of philosophy which deal only with these are naivetes. We immoralists, this world with which we are concerned, in which we have to fear and love, this almost invisible, inaudible world of delicate command and delicate obedience, a world of almost in every respect, captious, insidious, sharp and tender, yes, it is well protected from clumsy spectators and familiar curiosity. We are woven into a strong net and garment of duties and cannot disengage ourselves. Precisely here, we are men of duty, even we. Occasionally, it is true, we dance in our chains and betwixt our swords. It is nonetheless true that more often we gnash our teeth under the circumstances and are impatient at the secret hardship of our lot. But, do what we will, fools and appearances say of us, "These are men without duty." We always have fools and appearances against us. Honesty, granting that it is the virtue of which we cannot rid ourselves, we free spirits, well, we will labor at it with all our perversity and love, and not tire of perfecting ourselves in our virtue, which alone remains. May its glance some day overspread like a gilded blue mocking twilight this aging civilization with its dull, gloomy seriousness. And if, nevertheless, our honesty should one day grow weary and sigh and stretch its limbs and find us too hard and would fain have it pleasanter, easier, and gentler, like an agreeable vice, let us remain hard, we latest Stoics, and let us send to its help whatever devilry we have in us, our disgust at the clumsy and undefined, our we strive for the forbidden, our love of adventure, our sharpened and fastidious curiosity, our most subtle, disguised, intellectual will to power and universal conquest, which rambles and roves avidiously around all the realms of the future. Let us go with all our devils to the help of our God. It is probable that people will misunderstand and mistake us on that account. What does it matter? They will say, their honesty, that is their devilry and nothing else. What does it matter? And even if they were right, have not all gods hitherto been such sanctified, re-baptized devils? And after all, what do we know of ourselves? And what the spirit that leads us wants to be called? It is a question of names. And how many spirits we harbor? Our honesty, we free spirits, let us be careful lest it become our vanity, our ornament and ostentation, our limitation, our stupidity. Every virtue inclines to stupidity, every stupidity to virtue. Stupid to the point of sanctity, they say in Russia. Let us be careful lest out of pure honesty we eventually become saints and bores. Is not life 100 times too short for us to bore ourselves? One would have to believe in eternal life in order to. I hope to be forgiven for discovering that all moral philosophy hitherto has been tedious and has belonged to the soporific appliances, and that virtue, in my opinion, has been more injured by the tediousness of its advocates than by anything else. At the same time, however, I would not wish to overlook their general usefulness. It is desirable that as few people as possible should reflect upon morals, and consequently, it is very desirable that morals should not someday become interesting. But let us not be afraid. Things still remain today as they have always been. I see no one in Europe who has, or discloses, an idea of the fact that philosophizing concerning morals might be conducted in a dangerous, captious, and ensnaring manner, that calamity might be involved therein. Observe, for example, the indefatigable, inevitable English utilitarians. How ponderously and respectably they stalk on, stalk along in the footsteps of Bentham, just as he had already stalked in the footsteps of the respectable Helvetius. No new thought. Nothing of the nature of a finer turning or better expression of an old thought, not even a proper history of what had been previously thought on the subject. An impossible literature, taking it all in all, unless one knows how to leaven it with some mischief. In effect, the old English vice called cant, which is moral Tartuffism, has insinuated itself also into these moralists, whom one must certainly read with an eye to their motives if one must read them. Concealed this time under the new form of the scientific spirit. Moreover, there is not absent from them a secret struggle with the pangs of conscience, from which a race of former Puritans must naturally suffer in all their scientific tinkering with morals. Is not a moralist the opposite of a Puritan? That is to say, as a thinker who regards morality as questionable, as worthy of interrogation, in short, as a problem. Is moralizing not immoral? In the end, they all want English morality to be recognized as authoritative, inasmuch as mankind, or the general utility, or the happiness of the greatest number, no. The happiness of England will be best served thereby. They would like, by all means, to convince themselves that the thriving after English happiness, I mean after comfort and fashion, and in the highest instance, a seat in Parliament, is at the same time the true path of virtue. In fact, that insofar as there has been virtue in the world hitherto, it has just consisted in such striving. Not one of those ponderous, conscience-stricken, herding animals who undertake to advocate the cause of egoism as conducive to the general welfare wants to have any knowledge or inkling of the facts that the general welfare is no ideal. No goal, no notion that can be at all grasped, but is only a nostrum, that what is fair to one may not at all be fair to another, that the requirement of one morality for all is really a detriment to higher men. In short, that there is a distinction of rank between man and man, and, consequently, between morality and morality. They are an unassuming and fundamentally mediocre species of men, these utilitarian Englishmen, and, as already remarked, insofar as they are tedious, one cannot think highly enough of their utility. One ought even to encourage them, as has been partially attempted in the following rhymes. Hail ye worthies, barrow wheeling, longer, better, eye revealing, stiffer eye in head and knee, enraptured, never jesting, mediocre, everlasting, without genius and without wit. In these later ages, which may be proud of their humanity, there still remains so much fear, so much superstition of the fear, of the cruel wild beast, the mastering of which constitutes the very pride of these humaner ages, that even obvious truths, as if by the agreement of centuries, have long remained unuttered, because they have the appearance of helping the finally slain wild beast back to life again. I perhaps risk something when I allow such a truth to escape. Let others capture it again and give it so much milk of pious sentiment to drink that it will lie down quiet and forgotten in its old corner. One ought to learn anew about cruelty and open one's eyes. One ought at last to learn impatience in order that such immodest gross errors as, for instance, have been fostered by ancient and modern philosophers with regard to tragedy may no longer wander about virtuously and boldly. Almost everything that we call higher culture is based upon the spiritualizing and intensifying of cruelty. This is my thesis. The wild beast has not been slain at all. It lives. It flourishes. It has only been transfigured. That which constitutes the painful delight of tragedy is cruelty. That which operates agreeably in the so-called tragic sympathy and at the basis even of everything sublime up to the highest and most delicate thrills of metaphysics obtains its sweetness solely from the intermingled ingredient of cruelty. What the Roman enjoys in the arena, the Christian in the ecstasies of the cross, the Spaniard at the sight of the faggot and stake, or of the bullfight, the present-day Japanese who presses his way to the tragedy, the workman of Parisian suburbs who has a homesickness for bloody revolutions, the Wagnerine who, with unhinged will, undergoes the performance of Tristan and Isolde. What all these enjoy and strive with mysterious ardor to drink in is the filter of the great Circe cruelty. Here, to be sure, we must put aside entirely the blundering psychology of former times, which could only teach, with regard to cruelty, that it originated at the sight of the suffering of others. There is an abundant, superabundant enjoyment even in one's own suffering, in causing one's own suffering. And wherever man has allowed himself to be persuaded to self-denial in the religious sense, or to self-mutilation, as among the Phoenicians and ascetics, or in general to desensualization, decarnalization, and contrition, to puritanical repentance spasms, to vivisection of conscience, and to Pascal-like sacrifice of the intellect, he is secretly allured and impelled forwards by his cruelty, by the dangerous thrill of cruelty towards himself. Finally, let us consider that even the seeker of knowledge operates as an artist and glorifier of cruelty, in that he compels his spirit to perceive against its own inclination, and often enough against the wishes of his heart. He forces it to say nay, where he would like to affirm, love, and adore. Indeed, every instance of taking a thing profoundly and fundamentally is a violation, an intentional injuring of the fundamental will of the spirit, which instinctively aims at appearance and superficiality. Even in every desire for knowledge, there is a drop of cruelty. Perhaps what I have said here about a fundamental will of the spirit may not be understood without further details. I may be allowed a word of explanation. That imperious something, which is popularly called the spirit, wishes to be master internally and externally, and to feel itself master. It has the will of a multiplicity for a simplicity, a binding, taming, imperious, and essentially ruling will. Its requirements and capacities here are the same as those assigned by physiologists to everything that lives, grows, and multiplies. The power of the spirit to appropriate foreign elements reveals itself in a strong tendency to assimilate the new to the old, to simplify the manifold, to overlook or repudiate the absolutely contradictory, just as it arbitrarily re-underlines, makes prominent, and falsifies for itself certain traits and lines in the foreign elements, in every portion of the outside world. The object thereby is the incorporation of new experiences, the assortment of new things in the old arrangements. In short, growth, or, more properly, the feeling of growth, the feeling of increased power is its object. This same will has at its service an apparently opposed impulse of the spirit, a suddenly adopted preference of ignorance, of arbitrary shutting out, a closing of windows, an inner denial of this or that, a prohibition to approach, a sort of defensive attitude against much that is knowable, a contentment with obscurity, with the shutting in horizon, an acceptance and approval of ignorance, as that which is all necessary according to the degree of its appropriating power, its digestive power, to speak figuratively, and in fact, the spirit resembles a stomach more than anything else. Here also belong an occasional propensity of the spirit to let itself be deceived, perhaps with a waggish suspicion that it is not so-and-so, but is only allowed to pass as such, a delight in uncertainty and ambiguity, an exulting enjoyment of arbitrary, out-of-the-way narrowness and mystery, of the too near, of the foreground, of the magnified, the diminished, the misshapen, the beautified, an enjoyment of the arbitrariness of all these manifestations of power. Finally, in this connection, there is the not unscrupulous readiness of the spirit to deceive other spirits and dissemble before them, the constant pressing and straining of a creating, shaping, changeable power. The spirit enjoys therein its craftiness and its variety of disguises. It enjoys also its feeling of security therein. It is precisely by its protean arts that it is best protected and concealed, counter to this propensity for appearance, for simplification, for a disguise, for a cloak, in short, for an outside, for every outside is a cloak. There operates the sublime tendency of the man of knowledge, which takes and insists on taking things profoundly, variously, and thoroughly, as a kind of cruelty of the intellectual conscience and taste, which every courageous thinker will acknowledge in himself, provided, as it ought to be, that he has sharpened and hardened his eye sufficiently long for introspection, and is accustomed to severe discipline and even severe words. He will say, "There is something cruel in the tendency of my spirit." Let the virtuous and amiable try to convince him that it is not so. In fact, it would sound nicer if, instead of our cruelty, perhaps our extravagant honesty were talked about, whispered about, and glorified, we free, very free spirits, and some day, perhaps, such will actually be our posthumous glory. Meanwhile, for there is plenty of time until then, we should be least inclined to deck ourselves out in such florid and fringed moral verbiage. Our whole former work has just made us sick of this taste and its sprightly exuberance. They are beautiful, glistening, jingling, festive words. Honesty, love of truth, love of wisdom, sacrifice for knowledge, heroism of the truthful. There is something in them that makes one's heart swell with pride. But we anchorites and marmots have long ago persuaded ourselves in all the secrecy of an anchorite's conscience that this worldly parade of verbiage also belongs to the old false adornment, frippery, and gold dust of unconscious human vanity, and that even under such flattering color and repainting, the terrible original text, "Natural Man," must again be recognized. In effect, to translate man back again into nature, to master the many vain and visionary interpretations and subordinate meanings which have hitherto been scratched and daubed over the eternal original text, Homo Natura, to bring it about that man shall henceforth stand before man as he now, hardened by the discipline of science, stands before the other forms of nature, with fearless Oedipus eyes and stopped Ulysses ears, deaf to the enticements of old metaphysical bird catchers who have piped to him far too long, "Thou art more, thou art higher, thou hast a different origin." This may be a strange and foolish task, but that it is a task, who can deny? Why did we choose it, this foolish task? Or, to put the question differently, why knowledge at all? Everyone will ask us about this, and thus pressed, we, who have asked ourselves the question 100 times, have not found, and cannot find, any better answer. Learning alters us. It does what all nourishment does and does not merely conserve, as the physiologist knows. But at the bottom of our souls, quite down below, there is certainly something unteachable, a granite of spiritual fate, of predetermined decision and answer to predetermined chosen questions. In each cardinal problem, there speaks an unchangeable, I am this. A thinker cannot learn anew about man and woman, for instance, but can only learn fully. He can only follow to the end what is fixed about them in himself. Occasionally, we find certain solutions of problems which make strong beliefs for us. Perhaps they are henceforth called convictions. Later on, one sees in them only footsteps to self-knowledge, guideposts to the problem which we ourselves are, or, more correctly, to the great stupidity which we embody, our spiritual fate, the unteachable in us, quite down below. In view of this liberal compliment which I have just paid myself, permission will perhaps be more readily allowed me to utter some truths about woman as she is, provided that it is known at the outset how literally they are merely my truths. Woman wishes to be independent, and therefore she begins to enlighten man about woman as she is. This is one of the worst developments of the general uglifying of Europe. For what must these clumsy attempts of feminine scientificality and self-exposure bring to light? Woman has so much cause for shame. In woman, there is so much pedantry, superficiality, schoolmasterliness, petty presumption, unbridledness, and indiscretion concealed, study only women's behavior towards children, which has really been best restrained and dominated hitherto by the fear of man. Alas, if ever the eternally tedious in woman, she has plenty of it, is allowed to venture forth. If she begins radically and on principle to unlearn her wisdom and art of charming, of playing, of frightening away sorrow, of alleviating and taking easily, if she forgets her delicate aptitude for agreeable desires. Female voices are already raised, which, by St. Aristophanes, make one afraid. With medical explicitness, it is stated in a threatening manner what women first and last requires from man. Is it not the very worst taste that woman thus sets herself up to be scientific? Enlightenment hitherto has fortunately been men's affair, men's gift. We remained therewith among ourselves, and, in the end, in view of all that women write about women, we may well have considerable doubt as to whether woman really desires enlightenment about herself, and can desire it. If woman does not thereby seek a new ornament for herself, I believe ornamentation belongs to the eternally feminine, why then she wishes to make herself feared. Perhaps she thereby wishes to get the mastery. But she does not want truth. What does woman care for truth? From the very first, nothing is more foreign, more repugnant, or more hostile to woman than truth. Her great art is falsehood. Her chief concern is appearance and beauty. Let us confess it. We men, we honor and love this very art and this very instinct in woman. We who have the hard task and, for our recreation, gladly seek the company of beings under whose hands, glances, and delicate follies our seriousness, our gravity, and profundity appear almost like follies to us. Finally, I ask the question, did a woman herself ever acknowledge profundity in a woman's mind or justice in a woman's heart? And is it not true that on the whole, woman has hitherto been most despised by woman herself and not by all of us? We men desire that women should not continue to compromise herself by enlightening us, just as it was man's care and the consideration for women when the church decreed woman should be silent in church. It was to the benefit of woman when Napoleon gave the too eloquent Madame de Stael to understand woman should be silent when it comes to politics. And in my opinion, he is a true friend of woman who calls out to women today, woman should be silent about woman. It betrays corruption of the instincts, apart from the fact that it betrays bad taste. When a woman refers to Madame Roland or Madame de Staël or Monsieur George Sand as though something were proved thereby in favor of woman as she is. Among men, these are the three comical women as they are, nothing more, and just the best involuntary counter-arguments against feminine emancipation and autonomy. Stupidity in the kitchen. Woman as cook. The terrible thoughtlessness with which the feeding of the family and the master of the house is managed. Woman does not understand what food means, and she insists on being cook. If woman had been a thinking creature, she should, certainly, as cook for thousands of years, have discovered the most important physiological facts, and should likewise have got possession of the healing art. Through bad female cooks, through the entire lack of reason in the kitchen, the development of mankind has been longest retarded and most interfered with. Even today, matters are very little better. A word to high school girls. There are turns and casts of fancy. There are sentences, little handfuls of words, in which a whole culture, a whole society, suddenly crystallizes itself. Among these is the incidental remark of Madame de Lambert to her son, "My dear, never indulge in any follies but the ones that will give you a great deal of pleasure." The motherliest and wisest remark, by the way, that was ever addressed to a son. I have no doubt that every noble woman will oppose what Dante and Goethe believed about women. The former, when he sang, "She looked up and I ate her," and the latter, when he interpreted it, "The eternally feminine draws us aloft." For this is just what she believes of the eternally masculine. Seven apothegms for women. How the longest ennui flees when a man comes to our knees. Age, alas, and science stayed, furnish even weak virtue aid. Somber garb and silence meet, dress for every dame, discreet. Whom I thank when in my bliss, God and my good tailoress. Young, a flower-decked cavern home, old, a dragon thence may roam. Noble title, leg that's fine, man as well, oh, were he mine. Speech in brief and sense in mass, slippery for the jenny ass. Woman has hitherto been treated by men like birds, which, losing their way, have come down among them from an elevation as something delicate, fragile, wild, strange, sweet, and animating, but as something also which must be cooped up to prevent it flying away. To be mistaken in the fundamental problem of man and woman, to deny here the profoundest antagonism and the necessity for an eternally hostile tension, to dream here, perhaps, of equal rights, equal training, equal claims and obligations, that is a typical sign of shallow-mindedness, and a thinker who has proved himself shallow at this dangerous spot, shallow in instinct, may generally be regarded as suspicious, nay more, as betrayed, as discovered. He will probably prove too short for all fundamental questions of life, future as well as present, and will be unable to descend into any of the depths. On the other hand, a man who has depth of spirit as well as of desires, and has also the depth of benevolence which is capable of severity and harshness, and easily confounded with them, can only think of women as Orientals do. He must conceive of her as a possession, as confinable property, as a being predestined for service and accomplishing her mission therein. He must take his stand in this matter upon the immense rationality of Asia, upon the superiority of the instinct of Asia, as the Greeks did formerly. Those best heirs and scholars of Asia, who, as is well known, with their increasing culture and amplitude of power from Homer to the time of Pericles, became gradually stricter towards women, in short, more Oriental. How necessary, how logical, even how humanely desirable this was, let us consider for ourselves. The weaker sex has in no previous age been treated with so much respect by men as at present. This belongs to the tendency and fundamental taste of democracy. In the same way as disrespectfulness to old age, what wonder is it that abuse should be immediately made of this respect? They want more. They learn to make claims. The tribute of respect is at last felt to be well-nigh galling. Rivalry for rights. Indeed, actual strife itself would be preferred. In a word, woman is losing modesty. And let us immediately add that she is also losing taste. She is unlearning to fear man. But the woman who unlearns to fear sacrifices her most womanly instincts. That woman should venture forward when the fear-inspiring quality in man, or more definitely, the man in man, is no longer either desired or fully developed, is reasonable enough and also intelligible enough. What is more difficult to understand is that precisely thereby woman deteriorates. This is what is happening nowadays. Let us not deceive ourselves about it. Whenever the industrial spirit has triumphed over the military and aristocratic spirit, woman strives for the economic and legal independence of a clerk. Woman as clerkess is inscribed on the portal of the modern society, which is in course of formulation. When she thus appropriates new rights, aspires to be master, and inscribes progress of women on her flags and banners, the very opposite realizes itself with terrible obviousness. Woman retrogrades. Since the French Revolution, the influence of woman in Europe has declined in proportion as she has increased her rights and claims. And the emancipation of women, insofar as it is desired and demanded by women themselves, and not only by masculine shallow pates, thus proves to be a remarkable symptom of the increased weakening and deadening of the most womanly instincts. There is stupidity in this movement, an almost masculine stupidity, of which a well-reared woman, who is always a sensible woman, might be heartily ashamed. To lose the intuition as to the ground upon which she can most surely achieve victory, to neglect exercise in the use of her proper weapons, to let herself go before man, perhaps even to the book, where formerly she kept herself in control and in refined, artful humility, to neutralize, with her virtuous audacity, man's faith in a veiled, fundamentally different ideal in woman. Something eternally, necessarily feminine, to emphatically and loquaciously dissuade man from the idea that woman must be preserved, cared for, protected, and indulged, like some delicate, strangely wild, and often pleasant domestic animal. The clumsy and indignant collection of everything of the nature of servitude and bondage, which the position of woman in the hitherto existing order of society has entailed and still entails, as though slavery were a counter-argument, and not rather a condition of every higher culture, of every elevation of culture? What does all this betoken, if not a disintegration of womanly instincts, a defeminizing? Certainly, there are enough of idiotic friends and corruptors of woman among the learned asses of the masculine sex, who advise woman to defeminize herself in this manner, and to imitate all the stupidities from which man in Europe, European manliness, suffers, who would like to lower woman to general culture, indeed, even to newspaper reading and meddling with politics. Here and there, they wish even to make women into free spirits and literary workers, as though a woman without piety would not be something perfectly obnoxious or ludicrous to a profound and godless man. Almost everywhere, her nerves are being ruined by the most morbid and dangerous kind of music, our latest German music, and she is daily being made more hysterical and more incapable of fulfilling her first and last function, that of bearing robust children. They wish to cultivate her, in general, still more, and intend, as they say, to make the weaker sex strong by culture, as if history did not teach in the most emphatic manner that the cultivating of mankind and his weakening, that is to say, the weakening, dissipating, and languishing of his force of will, have always kept pace with one another, and that the most important and influential women in the world, and lastly, the mother of Napoleon, had just to thank their force of will, and not their schoolmasters, for their power and ascendancy over man. That which inspires respect in woman, and often enough fear also, is her nature, which is more natural than that of man, her genuine, carnivora-like, cunning flexibility, her tiger claws beneath the glove, her naivete in egoism, her untrainableness and innate wildness, the incomprehensibleness, extent, and deviation of her desires and virtues. That which, in spite of fear, excites one's sympathy for the dangerous and beautiful cat woman is that she seems more afflicted, more vulnerable, more necessitous of love, and more condemned to disillusionment than any other creature. Fear and sympathy it is with these feelings that man has hitherto stood in the presence of woman, always with one foot already in tragedy, which rends while it delights. What? And all that is now to be at an end? And the disenchantment of women is in progress? The tediousness of woman is slowly evolving? Oh, Europe! Europe! We know the horned animal, which was always most attractive to thee, from which danger is ever again threatening thee. Thy old fable might once more become history, and immense stupidity might once again overmaster thee and carry thee away, and no god concealed beneath it, no, only an idea, a modern idea. Chapter 8 Peoples and Countries. I heard, once again for the first time, Richard Wagner's Overture to the Master Singer. It is a piece of magnificent, gorgeous, heavy latter-day art which has the pride to presuppose 2 centuries of music as still living in order that it may be understood. It is an honor to Germans that such a pride did not miscalculate. What flavors and forces, what seasons and climes do we not find mingled in it? It impresses us at one time as ancient, at another time as foreign, bitter, and too modern. It is as arbitrary as it is pompously traditional. It is not infrequently roguish, still oftener rough and coarse. It has fire and courage, and, at the same time, the loose, dun-colored skin of fruits which ripen too late. It flows broad and full, and suddenly there is a movement of inexplicable hesitation, like a gap that opens up between cause and effect, an oppression that makes us dream, almost a nightmare. But already it broadens and widens anew, the old stream of delight, the most manifold delight of old and new happiness, including, especially, the joy of the artist in himself, which he refuses to conceal, his astonished, happy cognizance of his mastery of the expedients here employed, the new, newly acquired, imperfectly tested expedients of art, which he apparently betrays to us. All in all, however, no beauty, no south, nothing of the delicate southern clearness of the sky, nothing of grace, no dance, hardly a will to logic. A certain clumsiness, even, which is also emphasized, as though the artist wished to say to us, "It is part of my intention." A cumbersome drapery, something arbitrarily barbaric and ceremonious, a flurrying of learned and venerable conceits and witticisms, something German in the best and worst sense of the word, something in the German style, manifold, formless, and inexhaustible, a certain German potency and superplenitude of soul, which is not afraid to hide itself under the raffinements of decadence, which, perhaps, feels itself most at ease there, a real, genuine token of the German soul, which is at the same time young and aged, too ripe and yet still too rich in futurity. This kind of music expresses best what I think of the Germans. They belong to the day before yesterday and the day after tomorrow. They have, as yet, know today. We good Europeans, we also have hours where we allow ourselves a warm-hearted patriotism, a plunge and relapse into old loves and narrow views. I have just given an example of it. Hours of national excitement, of patriotic anguish, and all other sorts of old-fashioned floods of sentiment. Duller spirits may perhaps only get done with what confines its operations in us to hours and plays itself out in hours, in a considerable time. Some in half a year, others in half a lifetime, according to the speed and strength with which they digest and change their material. Indeed, I could think of sluggish, hesitating races which even in our rapidly moving Europe would require half a century ere they could surmount such atavistic attacks of patriotism and soil attachment and return once more to reason, that is to say, to good Europeanism. And while digressing on this possibility, I happened to become an ear witness of a conversation between two old patriots. They were evidently both hard of hearing and consequently spoke all the louder. "He has as much and knows as much philosophy as a peasant or a core student," said the one. "He is still innocent. But what does that matter nowadays? It is the age of the masses. They lie on their belly before everything that is massive. And so also in politics, a statesman who rears up for them a new Tower of Babel, some monstrosity of empire and power they call great. What does it matter that we more prudent and conservative ones do not meanwhile give up the old belief that it is only the great thought that gives greatness to an action or affair? Supposing a statesman were to bring his people into the position of being obliged henceforth to practice high politics, for which they were by nature badly endowed and prepared, so that they would have to sacrifice their old and reliable virtues out of love to a new and doubtful mediocrity. Supposing a statesman were to condemn his people generally to practice politics when they have hitherto had something better to do and think about, and when in the depths of their souls they have been unable to free themselves from a prudent loathing of the restlessness, emptiness, and noisy wranglings of the essentially politics-practicing nations. Supposing such a statesman were to stimulate the slumbering passions and avidities of his people, were to make a stigma out of their former diffidence and delight in aloofness, an offense out of their exoticism and hidden permanency, were to deprecate their most radical proclivities, subvert their consciences, make their minds narrow and their tastes national. What, a statesman who should do all this, which his people would have to do penance for throughout their whole future, if they had a future, such a statesman would be great, would he? "Undoubtedly," replied the other old patriot vehemently. "Otherwise, he could not have done it. It was mad, perhaps, to wish such a thing, but perhaps everything great has been just as mad at its commencement." "Misuse of words," cried his interlocutor contradictorily. "Strong, strong, strong and mad, not great." The old men had obviously become heated as they thus shouted their truths in each other's faces, but I, in my happiness and apartness, considered how soon a stronger one may become master of the strong, and also that there is a compensation for the intellectual superficializing of a nation, namely in the deepening of another. Whether we call it civilization or humanizing or progress, which now distinguishes the European, whether we call it simply without praise or blame by the political formula the democratic movement in Europe, behind all the moral and political foregrounds pointed to by such formulas, an immense physiological process goes on, which is ever extending the process of the assimilation of Europeans, their increasing detachment from the conditions under which, climactically and hereditarily, united races originate, their increasing independence of every different milieu that for centuries would fain inscribe itself with equal demands on soul and body, that is to say, the slow emergence of an essentially supernatural and nomadic species of man, who possesses, physiologically speaking, a maximum of the art and power of adaptation as his typical distinction. This process of the evolving European, which can be retarded in its tempo by great relapses, but will perhaps just gain and grow thereby in vehemence and depth, the still raging storm and stress of national sentiment pertains to it, and also the anarchism which is appearing at present. This process will probably arrive at results on which its naive propagators and panegyrists, the apostles of modern ideas, would least care to reckon. The same new conditions under which, on an average, a leveling and mediocrizing of man will take place, a useful, industrious, variously serviceable, and clever gregarious man, are in the highest degrees suitable to give rise to exceptional men of the most dangerous and attractive qualities. 4. While the capacity for adaptation, which is every day trying changing conditions and begins a new work with every generation, almost with every decade, makes the powerfulness of the type impossible, while the collective impression of such future Europeans will probably be that of numerous, talkative, weak-willed, and very handy workmen who require a master, a commander, as they require their daily bread, while, therefore, the democratizing of Europe will tend to the production of a type prepared for slavery in the most subtle sense of the term. The strong man will, necessarily in individual and exceptional cases, become stronger and richer than he has perhaps ever been before, owing to the unprejudicedness of his schooling, owing to the immense variety of practice, art, and disguise. I mean to say that the democratizing of Europe is at the same time an involuntary arrangement for the rearing of tyrants, taking the word in all its meanings, even in its most spiritual sense. I hear with pleasure that our sun is moving rapidly towards the constellation Hercules, and I hope that the men on this earth will do like the sun, and we foremost, we good Europeans. There was a time when it was customary to call Germans deep by way of distinction, but now that the most successful type of new Germanism is covetous of quite other honors, and perhaps misses smartness in all that has depth, it is almost opportune and patriotic to doubt whether we did not formerly deceive ourselves with that commendation. In short, whether German depth is not at bottom something different and worse, and something from which, thank God, we are on the point of successfully ridding ourselves. Let us try, then, to relearn with regard to German depth. The only thing necessary for the purpose is a little vivisection of the German soul. The German soul is above all manifold, varied in its source, aggregated and superimposed rather than actually built. This is owing to its origin. A German who would embolden himself to assert, "Two souls, alas, dwell in my breast," would make a bad guess at the truth, or, more correctly, he would come far short of the truth about the number of souls. As a people made up of the most extraordinary mixing and mingling of races, perhaps even with a preponderance of the pre-Aryan element as the people of the center in every sense of the term, the Germans are more intangible, more ample, more contradictory, more unknown, more incalculable, more surprising, and even more terrifying than other peoples are to themselves. They escape definition and are thereby alone the despair of the French. It is characteristic of the Germans that the question, "What is German?" never dies out among them. Kotzebue certainly knew his Germans well enough. "We are known," they cried jubilantly to him, but Sand also thought he knew them. Jean-Paul knew what he was doing when he declared himself incensed at Fichte's lying but patriotic flatteries and exaggerations. But it is probable that Goethe thought differently about Germans from Jean-Paul, even though he acknowledged him to be right with regard to Fichte. It is a question, what Goethe really thought about the Germans, but about many things around him he never spoke explicitly, and all his life he knew how to keep an astute silence. Probably he had good reason for it. It is certain that it was not the wars of independence that made him look up more joyfully any more than it was the French Revolution, the event on account of which he reconstructed his Faust, and indeed the whole problem of man was the appearance of Napoleon. There are words of Goethe in which he condemns with impatient severity, as from a foreign land, that which Germans take a pride in. He once defined the famous German turn of mind as indulgence towards its own and others' weaknesses. Was he wrong? It is characteristic of Germans that one is seldom entirely wrong about them. The German soul has passages and galleries in it. There are caves, hiding places, and dungeons therein. Its disorder has much of the charm of the mysterious. The German is well acquainted with the bypaths to chaos. And as everything loves its symbol, so the German loves the clouds and all that is obscure, evolving, crepuscular, damp, and shrouded. It seems to him that everything uncertain, undeveloped, self-displacing, and growing is deep. The German himself does not exist. He is becoming. He is developing himself. Development is therefore the essentially German discovery and hit in the great domain of philosophical formulas, a ruling idea which, together with German beer and German music, is laboring to Germanize all Europe. Foreigners are astonished and attracted by the riddles which the conflicting nature at the basis of the German soul propounds to them, riddles which Hegel systematized and Richard Wagner has in the end set to music. Good-natured and spiteful, such a juxtaposition, preposterous in the case of every other people, is unfortunately only too justified in Germany. One has only to live for a while among the Swabians to know this. The clumsiness of the German scholar and his social distastefulness agree alarmingly well with his physical rope-dancing and nimble boldness, of which all the gods have learnt to be afraid. If anyone wishes to see the German soul demonstrated for the eyes, let him only look at German taste, at German arts and manners. What boorish indifference to taste! How the noblest and the commonest stand there in juxtaposition! How disorderly and how rich is the whole constitution of this soul! The German drags at his soul. He drags at everything he experiences. He digests his events badly. He never gets done with them. And German depth is often only a difficult, hesitating digestion. And just as all chronic invalids, all dyspeptics like what is convenient, so the German loves frankness and honesty. It is so convenient to be frank and honest. This confidingness, this complacence, this showing the cards of German honesty is probably the most dangerous and the most successful disguise which the German is up to nowadays. It is his proper Mephistophelian art. With this, he can still achieve much. The German lets himself go, and thereby gazes with faithful